This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Got a friend.
KPFT Houston.
And this is KPFT Houston, the voice of Pacifica for the Upper Gulf Coast. Stay tuned for Monitor. Oh, there we go. 90.1 KPFT, 89.5 in Galveston. This is the monitor here in Houston. Pokey Anderson is away this week. She'll be joining us sometime in the next couple of weeks, we hope. The voice you heard there at the beginning is Otis McClay, a blast from the past. Actually, Otis, thank you for being here, engineering the show for us. Otis got me on the air on this station, so it's always good to see him. Joining me tonight in Pokey's seat, and a somewhat regular guest on this show, mostly to do with election issues, is Brad Friedman. Brad, nice to have you with us today.
Good to be here, Mark.
Here in person instead of on the phone, as usual.
In person, that's right.
We have a pretty busy show, two live guests for you. Brad, you're taking first slot. Who do you have for
us? I am indeed. Stephen Heller, the Diebold document whistleblower, is going to be with us here today. I don't think... Has he been on your show before?
I don't believe so. Although, if he had, Pokey would have set that up. Pokey is the election soldier.
She is indeed. And she keeps me on top of things as well. So, Stephen Heller is going to be here for the first time on the monitor to speak about... he's actually a felon. Have you had many felons on the show before?
We've had a couple. I'm not a felon in this country.
I see.
We have one fairly famous felon, I guess, was John Dean. Not too long ago, we spoke to him about various things to do with felonies in the White House. Is something he would know about.
Indeed.
The second guest, I guess, would know how to get felons behind bars, and that would be Marjorie Cohen. She's the president of the National Lawyers Guild. She's also an author of a new book called Cowboy Republic, Six Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law. She may want to update her title. I think there may be more than six.
She
talks about six of them in an awful lot of detail. And I'll be talking to her about two topics tonight. One will be the fourth branch of government, Dick Cheney.
Mm.
And the second will be the White House invoking executive privilege and saying that basically Congress has no authority to ask the Department of Justice to pursue contempt charges whenever there's executive privilege invoked. So should be an interesting discussion, and hopefully we'll help people understand some of the terminology that's being used, because I think a lot of people talk about the Constitution maybe without knowing it all that well. One guy who does that quite a lot, I guess, would be, I don't know, Alberto Gonzalez, maybe.
He knows it. He just doesn't pay attention to it.
And I mentioned last week another person who does this fairly frequently, who's currently Director of Central Intelligence, former head of the NSA, who didn't know what the Fourth Amendment was. We had Jonathan Landay on the air who talked about that a little bit some time ago. Anyway, moving on to the news here for the next few minutes, a little bit of a local connection to this first one. Federal investigators have uncovered what they're calling a sweeping network of kickbacks, bribes, fraud, involving at least eight companies and subcontractors of Kellogg Brown & Root. Now, Kellogg Brown & Root, we used to know here in Houston as a Halliburton subsidiary, has now been spun off as a separate company. But this scheme that the fraud investigators, federal investigators, found to inflate charges by flying freight into Iraq in support of the war, this is according to court papers unsealed on Friday. The latest conviction in the case is related to the scheme came again on Friday when a Houston-based executive for an air freight carrier hired by KBR, well, he pleaded guilty in federal court to dispensing bribes and then lying to federal investigators. This Kevin Andre Smoot, who's 43, from the Woodlands here in Texas, just about 40 miles north of where we're sitting, served as a managing director of Eagle Global Logistics Incorporated, and they received a subcontract from KBR to ship the freight. Of course, the original contract came from the federal government to KBR, but as we know very well, a lot of these contracts end up being subcontracted and the costs get inflated, and that's how we end up with things like the Army paying almost $4 a gallon for gas when they could get it themselves for $1.39. We've covered stuff like that in some detail, but I'm going to keep certainly following KBR in some detail as we continue to pursue this story. The company that we're talking about, Eagle, is a subcontractor to fulfill part of the mission of carrying military goods from Dubai in the UAE to Baghdad. But a scheme by Eagle executives, which started as far back as the end of 2003, basically the scheme involves a plane operated by a rival carrier, DHL, was struck by a missile and landed in Baghdad with its left wing on fire. The Eagle executives used that incident to charge a fraudulent war risk surcharge of 50 cents for every kilogram, which is about 2.5 pounds or so of freight, for its own flight. Between November of 2003 and July of 2004, Eagle made almost 380 flights as part of that subcontract, charging $13.3 million, an amount as a result of this surcharge that they added on because of something that happened to a different carrier from them, included $1.1 million in overcharges. It's not clear whether or not the company that subcontracted them, KBR, knew of this overcharging scheme, but the papers that Mr. Smoot and various other Eagle executives delivered, nearly $34,000 in what they're calling gratuities to KBR employees to, quote, obtain or reward favorable treatment, unquote, in connection with that contract. So it's a little bit stinky.
Not clear if KBR knew. Also not clear if KBR actually cared,
right,
to be frank. Our next report here goes back to what Mark was talking about at the top of the hour, and the Bush administration's rather incredible assertion this week, and I'm sure Marjorie Cohn will want to talk, you'll be talking more with her about this in a bit, but a report in the Washington Post on Friday quotes an anonymous senior Bush administration official saying that the president has the right to order the Justice Department not to pursue contempt charges that may be brought by the House against the administration itself. Mark J. Rosell, a professor of public policy at George Mason University who has written a book on executive privilege issues, called the administration's stance astonishing. That's a breathtakingly broad view of the president's role in this system of separation of powers, he said. What this statement is saying is that the president's claim of executive privilege trumps all. I spoke this week with Elizabeth De La Vega, former federal prosecutor and author of The United States versus George W. Bush, who said it's almost as if the Bush administration is asking to be impeached. That's what she said to me. She noted that the Post report was from an anonymous senior official, but said that should an extraordinary legal argument such as this be declared as official policy, that action in and of itself would be an impeachable offense, as she sees it. Also on Friday, Representative John Conyers, chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, under some pressure now from activists to bring impeachment charges, walked into a crowded room of supporters in San Diego and said, "What are we waiting for? Let's take these two guys out." Pretty extraordinary. This morning, also, Democratic Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold announced his intention to introduce a resolution of censure against George W. Bush. On today's Meet the Press, Feingold said this administration has assaulted the Constitution. The censure resolution will focus on two issues, the use of misleading statements and misuse of intelligence in the lead-up to war in Iraq, and for the, quote, outrageous attack on the rule of law, including illicit electronic surveillance and the administration approval of torture.
I would go as far as saying the Constitution is being waterboarded at an undisclosed location. I'm sure Margie will have a lot of comments on that, as you said, Brad, and
no doubt.
We'll get into it in some detail. A couple of updates on Guantanamo, a topic that we've been following here quite closely with several interviews and news headlines. The Court of Appeals on Friday ruled that lawyers for Guantanamo prisoners should have access to nearly all government evidence so they can challenge detainees' designation as unlawful enemy combatants. We know that this designation didn't exist really until fairly recently, and that there was some pressure on the administration initially to declare these people enemies of war. And that didn't work, of course, and the administration said that we can declare these people enemy combatants, unlawful enemy combatants. But what happened initially, Brad, I don't know if you remember all this, but the original documents said that these people were not unlawful enemy combatants, but just enemy combatants. So they had some issue figuring out legally where they stood, and the initial trials, military tribunals, I should say, not trials because there are no judges or juries here, but the military tribunals threw out the first two or three cases, and the government's had to reconsider a lot of what's going on at Guantanamo, and there's been some international pressure, obviously, to close it. Not that that would solve an awful lot, because, as we know, many of these prisoners then end up going to third countries where there's even less oversight than there is in Guantanamo. So that's not a solution that I would advocate.
You get the sense that they're just moving the goalposts
right.
every time?
Right.
Kicking it down the field until they're out of office, in
well,
theory,
yeah.
in 2009.
Absolutely. And another Guantanamo update is not for the first time. Several prisoners are protesting their treatment by carrying out hunger strikes. And as of yesterday, the U.S. military there twice a day at that military prison are force-feeding these Guantanamo Bay hunger-striking prisoners. As we know, no one yet has faced any criminal charges due to anything that they've been accused of, and they don't really have any rights, it would look like. So we'll keep following that story, as I said, and I'll post something up on our website to remind you of one of the authors that we've spoken to about Guantanamo. And that website, for reference, is themonitor.wordpress.com. You can get details of all of our guests, as well as download MP3 files of the show as soon as we're off the air.
Is it a good or bad thing that they're force-feeding these guys down at Guantanamo?
Well, I mean, they're trying to establish something through a hunger strike, so I presume it's against their will.
Mm-hmm.
If they get force-fed, that means they don't die, and if they don't die, I guess their cause doesn't get addressed or looked at in the media in public. So it tends to make more headlines if one of these prisoners dies, and it's happened before, and the story became quite big. So I guess force-feeding them to keep that out of the headlines is one tactic to use.
All right, back when Republicans controlled the Senate, their complaints against Democrats for blocking up or down votes on legislation led to threats of killing the use of filibusters in the Senate altogether, but times apparently have changed. Now that the Democrats are in the majority in that chamber, since the November 06 midterm elections, the Republicans have implemented a broad strategy of using the filibuster to stall any and all legislation. Margaret Telev of McClatchy Newspapers this week reported on the growing use of the filibuster by the Republicans. According to Telev, this year, Senate Republicans are threatening filibusters to block more legislation than ever before. By sinking a cloture vote this week to end filibuster, Republicans successfully blocked a Democratic bid to withdraw combat troops from Iraq by April 2008, even though a 52-49 Senate majority voted to end the filibuster, which takes 60 votes to bring to a close. This year, Republicans also have used the filibuster to block votes on immigration legislation, a no-confidence resolution for Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, and major legislation dealing with energy, labor rights, and prescription drugs. Nearly one in six roll call votes in the Senate this year have been cloture votes to attempt to end filibusters. If this pace of blocking legislation continues, this 110th Congress will be on track to roughly triple the previous record number of cloture votes, 58 each in the two Congresses from 99 to 2002, according to the Senate Historical Office. Meanwhile, the corporate mainstream media has been remarkably tepid in their use of the F word in their reporting. As with the recent debate on funding the Iraq War this week, often citing Democrats and their failure to pass legislation, rather than noting the Republicans' obstructionist efforts to block straight up or down votes on issues which a majority in Congress and in the Senate actually support.
There's actually one fairly rare public apology for that recently.
Is that right?
I forget the name of the lady who does the ABC.
Oh, Diane Sawyer.
That's exactly.
Right.
She apologized for the way she covered that vote. And, you know, it's nice to see them apologize every now and then.
Yeah, that's one. We've got a couple of thousand more to go, I suppose.
Right, very much related to that is, I mean, we talk a lot about how the media covers things here. And when we say media, we mean the corporate media. There were several quotes that are worthy of some coverage. There was an article recently that was pretty entertaining that looked at some of the false or very errant predictions that were made at various places, one by Margaret Thatcher, for example, claiming in 1972 that there will not be a woman prime minister in my lifetime. Another one of Ken Olson's 5 years after that, saying there's no reason why anybody would want a computer in their home. Of course, these quotes are very mistaken, and it's good to make a little bit of fun of them. But if we look at some other quotes specifically about Iraq that haven't been made fun of by anyone in the corporate press, let me give you a couple here. Christopher Hitchens, his name may be familiar to you, he said, quote, this will be no war. There will be a fairly brief and ruthless military intervention. The president will give an order. The attack will be rapid, accurate, and dazzling. It will be greeted by the majority of the Iraqi people as an emancipation, and I say bring it on.
Dazzling.
That was Christopher Hitchens. Richard Littlejohn, writing in The Sun in the UK, he says, quote, don't kid yourself. There is going to be war in Iraq unless Saddam Hussein's hands over his weapons of mass destruction are opened. He's got them. We know he's got them. He knows we know he's got them. Unquote. Maybe it's time for the media to apologize in general for a lot of this stuff. And the media covers things in a very bad way in a lot of times. And perhaps continuing this trend and furthering it, we've seen previous surveys talking about how people who watch various outlets have a more mistaken view of things than others. Of course, the top offender was the Fox network. And we know the Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation owns various outlets that push that sort of mistaken opinion on various people. Well, perhaps aware of this, a German publishing executive, Dieter von Honsblink, who used to be the director of the Dow Jones Company, resigned just recently to protest the Dow Jones board's endorsement of a deal to sell the company, which publishes the Wall Street Journal, to Mr. Murdoch's News Corporation. So, maybe this German publishing executive knows a little bit about what happens in publishing when he let Murdoch take over. I don't know. Anyway, that's, I guess, all the time we have. Let's take a very short break, and we'll come back to our first guest. You're listening to The Monitor here on KPFT. This is Mark Ravalli along with Brad Friedman. Stay tuned.
One quick news item here I want to get to right before we bring in our first guest, Stephen Heller, concerning election reform, which has finally made its way to Capitol Hill, only to perhaps be in the process of crashing and burning, as Democrats had declared election reform as one of their top priorities upon taking office last November, an action which was thought to be a response against problems with direct recording electronic touchscreen voting machines. A controversial bill offered by New Jersey Representative Rush Holt, however, has come under fire from both election officials and election integrity advocates, which I would certainly include myself as one of them over there at bradblog.com. County and state election officials say the Holt bill, H.R. 11, is too draconian to be accomplished in time for the 08 elections. Election integrity advocates complain the bill does not go far enough, most importantly in its failure to ban DRE touchscreen voting machines. This week, in a series of articles, the New York Times reported that H.R. 811 and perhaps federal election reform in general may now be all but dead. Representative Rush Holt is said to be working on a compromised version of the legislation with House leadership, but even some of the bill's previous supporters, such as VerifiedVoting.org, have now come out against a proposed compromise, which would do little more than add so-called paper trails to DRE touchscreen voting machines. I have learned, however, that some election integrity advocates have been working in the background to create alternate election reform legislation, which may be feasible for implementation in time for the 08 elections. House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer, one of the original co-sponsors of the Help America Vote Act of 2002, or HAVA, has cited disability and blind voters as a reason to keep these DRE voting machines in use in America. Nowhere in the Times article, however, did the Times point out that blind and disabled voters can use non-tabulating touchscreen equipment, which provides the same access and interface as DRE systems, but without the security flaws and dangers. The difference between these two types of systems has been obfuscated by supporters of the Holt bill, a number of disabled rights groups as well, such as the National Federation for the Blind and the American Association of People with Disabilities, AAPD. Both groups have, by the way, received thousands, if not millions of dollars from the voting machine vendors. Well, our first guest up today certainly has some thoughts on the corporate privatization of our electoral system. Stephen Heller, an actor who lives in Los Angeles, had been working as an overnight temporary word processor at one of the nation's most powerful Republican law firms in 2004 when he came across some troubling documents. The documents that Heller saw showed that the law firm Jones Day had been advising their client, the powerful voting machine company Diebold, of Texas, by the way, on how to skirt laws which they had appeared to have violated when they had installed uncertified software and hardware in several California counties just prior to the 2004 election. Heller, whose story has led him to be described as the Diebold document whistleblower, printed out hundreds of those documents and shared them with election integrity advocates at blackboxvoting.org. In turn, the documents were then released to the media, and soon enough, the state of California, under former Secretary of State Kevin Shelley, had decertified the electronic voting systems in the state, which the Diebold Corporation had illegally and secretly updated. Almost a year and a half after the incident, Heller was charged with three felony counts by the Los Angeles District Attorney. The case was criticized by many whistleblower advocates who contended that Heller's act was a public service for the greater good and that he should be regarded as a whistleblower rather than a criminal for having stolen what were, in fact, attorney-client privileged documents. Heller recently agreed to plead guilty to one of the three counts in exchange for no prison time and the hopeful reduction of the felony charge to a misdemeanor after 18 months of good behavior. Since then, he's become a vocal and powerful advocate for election reform and has spoken out against private corporate control of American elections at bradblog.com, where he has guest blogged on the topic, and elsewhere. Stephen Heller now joins us from Los Angeles on the monitor. Welcome, Stephen. How are you, sir?
I'm fine, Brad. Thanks for having me on, and hello to Mark as well.
Good to have you here. Please, by the way, I'm on the road all summer long, so if you could drive by my house and make sure everything's okay there, I'd appreciate it, Steve.
I'm going to check it out right away.
Thank you, sir. Okay. All right. Why did you agree to plead guilty to the single felony charge, Steve?
Well, first and foremost, because I actually did the crime. I was pleading guilty to a crime I committed, and it was a serious crime. I stole and exposed attorney-client privilege documents, and that is a very serious crime. It's something that should not be done, and I did it, and so I pled guilty to it. And also, in pleading guilty, I was able to avoid jail time, and I was able to get a signed document from the law firm that they would not sue me in civil court over the matter.
Is it, in fact, a crime at this point? And I ask because you may know more about the whistleblower laws than I do at this point. Is there not some sort of dispensation for acts like this when they are, in fact, in the public good?
Well, according to my attorney, whistleblower laws do protect a person from certain legal action, but I'm sorry, certain civil action is what I mean to say, but they don't protect you from legal consequences. And because the documents I stole were attorney-client privilege, that puts it in a different realm. They weren't just private company memos. They were documents generated by lawyers under attorney-client privilege. And again, breaking attorney-client privilege is a very serious crime, and I acknowledge that I committed a serious crime. I do also like to say that what's illegal isn't, in all circumstances, wrong. But I did commit a serious crime.
Explain to us the process a little bit that you went through. When you first discovered these documents, you're working there late at night as a word processor, and you were faced with the decision of whether to disclose them or not to the public.
Yeah, it was a very stressful couple of days. I saw what I saw, and I can't talk about what I saw because that material was and still is attorney-client privilege, and talking about it, or exposing it, rather, is what got me in trouble in the first place. But I saw what I saw, and it disturbed me greatly. I honestly and genuinely believed then, and still believe, that what I was seeing was a direct threat to the integrity of our entire democracy. And so that is what led me to decide, eventually, after not that long, about 2 days, I decided this information must be exposed regardless of the legality of it, because I decided that breaking one law in order to try to keep our democracy intact, I decided it was worthwhile.
Well, it's part of your plea agreement, I suppose, to not talk about those documents. I have seen some of those documents, and I can talk about them, and folks can certainly find them online. They were rather extraordinary. I mean, they essentially acknowledged that the company had, in fact, broken the law, and they said, well, here's how you can go about explaining your way out of this. And in fact, they listed what the cost would be for them to be represented. And there was even a note which certainly is of note to you now that you've turned a blogger out there. There was hundreds of thousands of dollars listed that it would cost them to monitor websites and blogs, I guess, like the Brad blog and Black Box Voting and so forth. What are your thoughts on that? That these companies are actually attorneys from these companies are actually covering blogs like ours, folks who articles that you write in order to basically do positive PR spin on what is in fact a crime, as I see it, that occurred in our elections.
Well, I think it's indicative of the fact that these companies are a lot more concerned about keeping the lid on dissent about their products than they are about manufacturing products that would actually be a benefit to our democracy. I still believe that if, right from the beginning, back I think in the late 90s when Diebold first began to get into the election machine business, if they'd just come out flat-footed and said, look, we want to work with the government, we want to work with the America's leading computer experts to create a voting system that will be accurate and secure and really work well. If they'd come out flat-footed and work with other people to do that, I think that they could have created a system that, first of all, would have made their company lots and lots of money, but also, and more importantly, would have been a genuine benefit to the voting process in America. But because from the beginning everything had to be secret and they had to cover up the fact that their machines were not working well, that the software was flawed, and they had to keep everything hidden away and keep a big happy face pasted on their company name, I think they ended up shooting themselves in the foot.
They went about this, it seems, as a private corporation would go about anything, selling ATM machines to banks, as some of these companies do. Certainly Diebold does. And I don't think they understood the difference between this sort of business. This is not, this is the bottom of our, the very root of our democracy here.
That's absolutely right.
And I think, and I'd like love your opinion on this, it seems to me, had they made different choices early on, they said, yes, we're going to make money here, but we're going to fully disclose all of our source code. We're going to be fully transparent in this process. I think we would be in a different place than we are now, where folks like you and me are, I would be just fine with seeing these guys go out of business the way they operate.
That's right. And I think had they done, like we said, just come out open in the beginning and made the source code open source and worked openly with computer experts and with voting integrity experts to build a fine system, again, they would have made lots and lots of money, and Diebold would be considered an American hero.
Now, did you have these sorts of opinions about our democracy and about the election system before you saw these documents, or has this been a process that you've gone through since you were, there was a year or so you couldn't even talk because you were under felony indictment. When did you become an election integrity advocate?
Well, after the 2000 election. Well, let me start a little bit before that. Before the 2000 election, like most Americans, I thought voting in America is pretty secure. I thought, yeah, maybe some small town in Iowa, the mayor's brother-in-law stuffs the ballot box so he can keep his job. But, for the most part, elections in America are secure and they are accurate. But after the 2000 election, I began to look into things more and began to read a lot of news articles from outside the United States, because inside the United States, the only news you could find was about hanging chads.
Right.
But there was nothing in the American press about electronic voting. I first began to read about that in late 2000, early 2001 in the foreign press, articles and papers from the UK, from Scoop in New Zealand. There was even an article in a Japanese paper, I forget the name, I think it's Mainichi Daily News, they had an article about electronic voting and the extensive web of connections, political, financial, and personal connections between Diebold and the Republican Party. And I began to read about this stuff, as I said, in late 2000, early 2001, and began to really be concerned about whether or not our elections were accurate, whether or not people who were being elected were really being elected. And so in January of 2004, when I first saw these documents, I think, more than most Americans, and that's not bragging, that's just because I went and read about stuff outside the United States, I knew more about it than most Americans did.
And so when you came across these documents then, did you know exactly what you were going to do with them, that you were going to give them to Bev Harris at blackboxvoting.org?
Well, at first, because I grew up during Vietnam and Watergate, I've always thought of the press as the fourth estate, the great watchdog. If you see something dirty in government or in corporations, get it to the press. They'll shine some sunlight on it, and that's how you expose it.
Oh, silly you, Steve.
Silly me, because like I said, at that point, nothing in the mainstream press in America, and only very little in the outside the mainstream American press, had had anything about electronic voting. And I thought, if I steal these documents and commit this crime and expose myself to that risk, and send them to reporters and editors, they're either going to end up in the trash can or in somebody's file drawer. Even if somebody wants to write about it, I fully believe that the higher-ups of that reporter's chain of command would tell him or her, kill the story, you're not writing about that. So I decided I can't go to the press as I would have done maybe 15 or 20 years ago. I need to go to somebody that I know is going to understand what these documents mean and will have the connections to get them to the authorities and to the press, and that was Bev Harris. I had read her book, Black Box Voting, and knew of her, so I contacted her.
And she, in fact, passed these documents on to Ian Hoffman of the Oakland Tribune.
Yes.
And he ran them. What was the reaction, and was what happened thereafter what you had expected to happen, what you had hoped would happen?
Well, yes, actually it was, because the documents and the information therein was exposed, and that was my intent. And then, after they were exposed, and in part because of the information in those documents, former California Secretary of State Kevin Shelley decertified a number of Diebold model machines in California. He was quoted, and this is an exact quote, he said, their behavior has been despicable. And he said, and this is another quote, you can find this in a New York Times article that interviewed him, he said, Diebold's behavior is reprehensible, and they tried to pull a fast one on the voters of California. And so he decertified their equipment, and I thought, hey, this is exactly what I hoped would happen, and I guess you could say my work here is done.
Well, that was the good news.
Yeah.
And then the cops busted into your house one morning, and a few months later you find yourself with three felony charges.
Yeah, actually in August of 2004, which is roughly 5 months after I'd stolen the documents, the police served a felony search warrant on my house just after dawn on Friday the 13th, actually, of August 2004. And then I wasn't charged until February of 2006, which was slightly more than 2 years after my theft and a full year and a half after the search warrant was served.
How do you explain the time difference?
Well, my attorney has repeatedly said she finds it very interesting that there was such a lag between the investigation and my being charged. And we fully believe that it was because Diebold did not want a news story about this guy who'd stolen these documents and exposed their crooked software coming out. They didn't want a news story about that coming out just before the November election.
I do also note that January of 2006 was a deadline for the Help America Vote Act, now that you mention it.
How convenient.
Yeah, where all of the states and counties essentially had to have their contracts done. And then in February of 2006, let's go get old Steve Heller. What would you have done differently, Steve, if you had to go back and do it again? Anything?
Well, again, I fully acknowledge I committed a serious crime, and stealing or violating attorney-client privilege is something people just should not do. Attorney-client privilege is very important to any system of justice. But I have to say that I would do what I did again, because the information that was exposed absolutely had to come out. As I said a little earlier, what's illegal is not always wrong. I committed a serious crime, but I think I did a little bit to help prevent a much more serious crime, which would be the theft of our entire republic.
Steve, what is what's needed at this point for real election reform in America? I mean, we've got a mess on our hands. You heard the story that I read at the top of the interview here about the mess that's going on in D.C. We've got folks all over the country, election advocates, frankly, heroes on the ground fighting from county to county, state to state. What's the bottom line here? How do we solve this mess and get to a place where we can once again have confidence that our elections are accurate and secure?
Well, first of all, in my view, we must make sure that federal law requires every vote in every election, no exceptions, to have an actual legal paper ballot. I don't want to see invisible electronic bits and bytes counted as votes. I want to see paper ballots counted as votes.
And that's different than the paper trails that we see folks are adding to these direct recording electronic devices. I know out here in Houston, I believe they use the HART InterCivic DRE systems that have no paper trail whatsoever, but we don't want to merely adding a paper trail does not do the trick.
That's right. We need to have real ballots, an actual legal ballot that's created with every vote, and the ballots are what should be counted, the paper ballots. And that way, if there's questions about the election, you can go back to the paper ballots. You don't have to worry, well, the voting machines have been sent back to the company and their memory's wiped, and so now we can't talk about it, which is the problem that a judge in out here in California recently voided the results of a 2004 referendum and said you got to hold the election again. In part because of the documents I exposed, the judge said, in effect, that we know the machines had illegal software, and the machines have since been had their memory wiped, and there were no paper ballots, so we can't verify whether the election results were accurate, so therefore, we have to hold the election again. If they'd had paper ballots in the first place, they could go back and look at them.
Well said. Here we are, 2007, and in America, the United States of America, we're fighting for a paper ballot.
I know.
I
can't believe that. It blows my mind that people aren't marching in the streets saying, just as simple as that, let's have a paper ballot for every vote. I think that's the first thing we have to do. And the second thing we have to do is essentially turn voting machines or these computer voting machines into really glorified word processors. The machine is used to create and then print out an actual paper ballot. If we do that, then a lot of the fears and concerns about electronic voting machines will go away. If the machine's been hacked, your paper ballot's going to show something's wrong. If the machine isn't working right, again, your ballot's going to show it. Let's make these machines used only to make choices for your votes and then push a print button and you get to look at the ballot, hold it in your hand, look at it, make sure it's a true reflection of your choices, and if it is, you put it in a privacy envelope and hand it to the precinct officer and he or she puts it in a locked box and later on it's counted. I don't see why that's so difficult.
Stephen Heller, the Diebold document whistleblower, I want to thank you for joining us here today, Stephen. Also, thank you again for your the courage that you've shown in not only speaking out on this thing, but doing the right thing, getting those documents to the right people, and frankly, facing felony charges. So thank you, Stephen, for all you're doing.
Well, thank you, Brad, and I know you're on a time crunch, but before you go, I just want to tell people to look for a documentary that's going to be coming out in a few months called Uncounted. It's about the election integrity movement, and it has a little bit about me in there as well. And also, it features our friend and ally, Brad Friedman.
Oh, he's very good.
Yes, he
does, is. Does that Uncounted have anything to do with Mr. Greenwald?
Which Greenwald?
Robert Greenwald.
Oh, no, but it's another Un-movie.
Okay.
I know what you're talking about.
Okay. He tends to pick those titles, so I was just wondering.
He does. Don't give him any ideas for a lawsuit. this film, Uncounted, is by David Earnhardt, and actually it is a terrific film. I'm looking forward to seeing the final version myself. Hey, thank you for taking some time out on your Sunday to be with us, Stephen.
And Stephen, I guess he's on hold right now, but I wanted to echo Brad's thoughts and thank him for what he's done, because people like Stephen and some other people that we've had on our show, including, you know, Daniel Ellsberg, Sybille Edmonds, and others, if it's not for the insider information that we get from those people, we may never know what actually is going on. So thank you, Stephen, and everybody else like him. Let's keep blowing those whistles from the inside to inform the citizenry. With that said, we'll take a very short break, and we'll be right back with you and Marjorie Cohen here on The Monitor. Stay tuned. Here on KPFT in Houston. This is Mark Bavari along with Brad Friedman, special guest host this week and maybe even next. Brad, thanks again for joining us. And joining us now live, once again, from a couple of weeks ago, is a fairly regular guest we've had on this show, Marjorie Cohen. Marjorie, welcome back to the show.
My pleasure, Mark.
Marjorie is a frequent analyst, as I said, on the monitor here. She also, you know, in her spare time has written a couple of books you might want to take a look at, including her latest called Cowboy Republic, Six Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law. And I was joking working with Brad, Marjorie, that you may want to add more than just six in the next edition of the book. But the six that you put in there are all very relevant, and we've discussed them in one way or another here on the show. And I want to devote some special time to discussing the book once I've read it. I've got a copy in my hands, and once I've worked my way through it, we'll get you back on and talk about it in some detail. But I suspect what we're going to talk about tonight could be easily framed along the lines of those six transgressions that the Bush administration is guilty of. Marjorie is also the president of the National Lawyers Guild, professor of law at Thomas Jefferson School of Law. She teaches criminal law, procedure, evidence, and international human rights, and a great constitutional expert. So, Marjorie, thanks again for coming in tonight. So, let's start with this latest assertion now by the administration that executive privilege affects the Department of Justice's ability to respond to congressional requests. And let's do that, if we can, by explaining some of the terminology. First of all, what is executive privilege?
Well, executive privilege is an assertion that the president or another official of the executive branch makes when they refuse to give Congress or the courts or a private party any information that has been requested or subpoenaed, or when they order government witnesses not to testify before Congress or a congressional committee.
And this has been applied lately to testimony from Harriet Myers, the non-testimony from Harriet Myers. And just recently, as we mentioned last week, it was applied to the Pat Tillman case. All the files supposedly related to details of his death have now been cited as some kind of executive privilege, and that his family and the American public at large is not going to get to hear what exactly happened and how that incident was investigated. So how does, it seems to be kind of a confrontation looming here between the White House and the Congress over the Constitution. And I told you off the air that when I started this show, that if anyone had said, you know, you'll be talking quite a lot about the Constitution, I would have thought they were crazy. This is a fairly old document, but it seems to have been reinterpreted more by this administration than by several consecutive administrations combined. What's going on exactly?
Well, that's, you know, Chapter 6 of my book is called Refusing to Execute the Law, and that talks about Bush's unprecedented use of these signing statements where the Constitution gives Congress the power to make law, and once both houses of Congress have passed a law, the president has two choices. He can sign it or he can veto it. Bush rarely vetoes a bill, but he attaches a signing statement, which he's done over 1,000 times, saying, I'm the commander-in-chief, and I will basically enforce only those parts that I think should be enforced. And he also, after John Yoo sent him a memo a few weeks later, he started using the phrase unitary executive in his signing statements. And a unitary executive is really what is at the heart of his refusal to honor these subpoenas. And that, it sounds like an innocuous phrase, but it's really a very ultra-right-wing theory of presidential power, which basically says that all executive power resides in the president, and in fact, all power, period. And that's the way Bush has been acting every single day. There's an example of this coming out where Bush has defied the Congress, the courts, precedent, and this comes, of course, from Dick Cheney, who thought that the role of the executive had been weakened during Watergate and Vietnam, and he is trying to elevate the executive power to an almost a kingly level.
Well, I certainly want to talk about Dick Cheney a few minutes from now with his assertion that he's not really part of either branch of government somehow. But let's stay with this, just to clear up some of the terminology again. There's been some discussion around this issue now of the Department of Justice refusing to pursue these contempt charges from Congress because of this executive privilege, as I've said. There's now been some discussion of inherent contempt. Can you describe what that is?
Well, inherent contempt comes into play when the it's one alternative that the Congress has. Generally, what should happen is under a specific statute, 2 U.S.C. 194, once the House of Representatives or even the Senate vote to hold a witness in contempt or the executive in contempt for refusing to honor a subpoena,
as they're now proposing around the Harriet Myers testimony.
Right.
Yeah.
Then they have to certify that to the United States Attorney for the District of Columbia, and then this statute says that the U.S. attorney, whose duty it shall be to bring the matter before the grand jury for its action. It's a very clear statute. The Supreme Court has upheld it, and yet the Bush administration is thumbing its nose at it and saying we are going to tell the U.S. attorney that they cannot bring any action. So the other alternative in the face of that defiance by the executive is called inherent contempt. And that in inherent contempt, either House of Congress, the House or the Senate, can order the sergeant at arms to take a witness into custody, in a witness who refuses to answer, for example, and have them held in the bowels of the courthouse, or in the bowels of the Capitol,
Congress, yeah,
until they agree to cooperate. Mm-hmm. Generally, they turn them over to the warden of the D.C. jail, but that's what inherent contempt is. It hasn't been used since, I think, 1934, I believe. And, you know, the problem is...
So, just to interrupt you for a second, Marjorie, so the outcome of this would be some sort of trial within the Capitol building?
Right, exactly. It would be a trial within Congress. You know, if you strip it all away, what are they trying to hide? Why won't they talk about whether or not the firing of these U.S. attorneys was political? I mean, the executive, the president, says, well, I can hire and fire anybody I want in the U.S. Attorney's Office. That's true, but the Supreme Court has said very clearly in Berger versus U.S. that the prosecutor's job is to see that justice is done and not to politicize justice, and there's overwhelming evidence that these U.S. attorneys have been doing that. And you wonder what they're hiding with the Pat Tillman case. What are they covering up? It would be so easy for them to just comply with these subpoenas, and it remains to be seen whether the Congress is going to stand up to the president. They haven't yet on almost anything.
Well, with the Pat Tillman case, I have to wonder if they're going to somehow retroactively classify documents that were in the public sphere originally. I've got Brad Friedman here with me, Marjorie, and he wants to break in with a question. So just so you know his voice this is as well. Go ahead, Brad.
Yes, quick question. Marjorie, one point I wanted to make. I did talk with the Conyers, John Conyers folks, a week or two ago, and they did, in fact, confirm there actually is a cell in the basement of the Senate, of the Capitol building, which could be quite interesting if they choose to use it. But I was speaking yesterday with Elizabeth De La Vega, former federal prosecutor, who said that the Bush administration, their assertion, currently the assertion that they can't bring, ordering the D.C. Attorney to not bring charges or to not bring a grand jury, that is currently only an anonymous official who's made that charges to the Washington Post. But if that actually becomes federal policy of George W. Bush's, that in and of itself would be an impeachable offense. Do you share that thought?
Yes, I think it would. I mean, it's high crimes and misdemeanors. Defying a subpoena of Congress is a crime.
But then that's coming out and ordering the D.C. attorney or the Justice Department that, you know, you cannot bring these contempt charges that the Congress has asked you to, that in and of itself is also a crime, correct?
I believe so. I mean, I read the New York Times, yesterday's New York Times, as very clearly saying that the White House says the Justice Department would not pursue contempt charges. In other words, they would be likely to block it, any efforts. And so, that's what the New York Times is quoting a White House spokesman. Uh-huh. The New York Times often quotes anonymous sources, and so it seems pretty clear that that is the posture of the Bush administration, that they're going to tell the U.S. attorney not to take the case to the grand jury. This is assuming that, first of all, that the Congress, one or both houses of Congress, pass by a majority an order of contempt. Remember, the filibuster rules still apply and the cloture procedure still applies, so the Republicans could block that.
In the Senate. But the House
in the Senate
could
be
a lot easier.
Yeah, that's true. But in the House, the House seems to be, of course, consistently more progressive than the Senate, and we've seen that, of course, lately with the Iraq War vote.
We also saw it on the issue of Dick Cheney, which is something I wanted to get to you as well in the time that we have left. Dick Cheney said that he wasn't bound by rules governing the administration in terms of handling secret documents. He refused to comply with requests based on that topic, and he said that the reason was that he's not part of the executive, he's part of the legislative branch, and then there was a move in Congress to defund the vice president's office. There's a Freudian slip. I said the president's office. So, and of course, that vote, as we know, collapsed. I think 12 or 13 Democrats caved in and didn't follow through. Constitutionally, Marjorie, and legally, the vice president's position is what exactly? Is he legislative or executive, or what's going on?
Well, of course he's part of the executive branch. I mean, he's only the president of the Senate to break a tie in the event of a tie. I mean, he has very few so-called legislative powers. But, you know, listen, to think about it this way. Let's assume that Cheney, the vice president, is not part of the executive branch. Well, wouldn't that mean that a claim of executive privilege, he wouldn't be able to claim executive privilege?
Well, he's tried to have it both ways. No, exactly. This is what I'm trying to get at. And I guess the underlying issue around all of this is that I don't know. Obviously, the Bush administration and Alberto Gonzalez and various other people, you mentioned Mr. Wu there, who gave various legal advice, who I guess from my limited understanding of the law and international law specifically, would be in contravention of various conventions that this country has signed. But as far as the legal position, I just want to get this out so that everyone's clear, because the administration is very good at confusing people, and there were some people who appeared to buy this idea that Dick Cheney presented, that he's not part of the executive branch. So I just want to put a line under it and be done with that topic. He is part of the executive branch, obviously.
Of course he is, and it's ridiculous. I mean, it's phenomenal what has come out of that White House, and the fact that the media, the corporate media, repeats much of it as if it were true.
Yeah.
And it's up to shows like yours and blogs like mine, MarjorieCode.com, and other alternative news sources to really get the truth out, because it's just astounding, the claims that the Bush administration has made, and this is one of the more astounding claims, that Cheney is not part of the executive branch.
Marjorie, you've been following the administration too closely. You just did a preemptive strike on me. I was about to mention your website. That website is www.marjoriecohen.com, and Marjorie spells her last name without an E, so it's MarjorieCohn.com. If that was too quick for you, go to our website, themonitor.wordpress.com. You'll find Marjorie's bio, link to her website, and a little bit more about the work she does, including this book, Marjorie, which we've mentioned the title, but we haven't had an awful lot of time to discuss it, and I want to have a special segment to go into that, because the things that we've been talking about today are only really covered by this sixth and final chapter of the book, Refusing to Execute the Law, but there are some other ones that are really interesting, to me at least, specifically Guantanamo and execution, willful killing and torture, which is chapters 2, 3, and 4 of the book. Spying on Americans, we've had you on to discuss that before, the NSA warrantless wiretap case. So, in summary, if you would, in the next few minutes, tell me where you think this is going. Is there going to be some kind of constitutional showdown? If there is, who holds sway and where is it likely to go?
Well, I think there may well be a constitutional showdown, and if you look at what has happened in the past, this is not the first time that the president has claimed executive power and that there's been a so-called constitutional showdown since 1975. I think some 10 cabinet-level or senior executive officials have been cited for contempt by committees or subcommittees of Congress for failing to produce documents in response to subpoenas. But in every case, the White House and Congress have negotiated an agreement. And in the overwhelming number of cases, the White House backs down and produces the documents. I suspect that we're going to see stonewalling here that's unprecedented by the Bush White House, by Bush and Cheney.
Well, the view of just buying time, or what's the eventual view, do you think? I know I'm asking you to speculate a little bit.
Well, I think that they're gambling that the courts are going to uphold them if this stuff gets into the courts, and they may well be right. I mean, Bush has really succeeded in putting many right-wingers on the court, certainly
exactly.
On the Supreme Court, and it's very delicately balanced, and they may be true.
Well,
they may be right in their risk.
Right, this is what I'm trying to get at, because at the root of all of this is if it's pushed up as far as the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court rules in favor of the administration, then we've set all sorts of precedents that subsequent administrations can then follow. So where then in the long term does this whole unitary executive idea go? Because it seems like it's been shifted in one direction by this administration, and if it does get as far as the Supreme Court ruling and the Supreme Court upholds it, then the Constitution and America the American Republic may be in much graver danger than it would have been otherwise. What's your take on that?
I think that's true, and I think what the Republicans don't realize is that if a Democrat gets into power, the Democrat can use these unprecedented powers if they are indeed upheld. So far, I believe the only Supreme Court justice to mention the unitary executive concept with approval has been Clarence Thomas in a dissent. But I suspect and I think that this goes along with, I think Samuel Alito has also, before he got on the Supreme Court, talked approvingly of this doctrine of unitary executive. But, you know, there are also a number of people who are wondering whether indeed Bush and Cheney are going to give up this presidency, because they have been so secretive and so intent on giving themselves immunity and so intent on staying in Iraq. They have no intention of ever pulling out of Iraq, or they wouldn't be building mega bases and mega embassies and pushing to privatize Iraq's oil to be controlled by foreign oil companies.
Mm-hmm.
So there's various executive orders that Bush has been issuing, and many people think they may be laying the basis for Bush to, not necessarily a legal basis, but a basis for Bush to claim that in the event of some kind of so-called catastrophic emergency, which could be an anti-war demonstration shutting down the Capitol for part of a day, that he declares martial law and decides that it's too dangerous, or maybe there's a bio-terrorist attack or something that they claim is too dangerous to go ahead with the election. And then, of course, in 2008, and then, of course, the question is whether the military will turn on the people. And they may well not.
Marjorie, Brad Friedman again. Mark was talking about the courts are going to fall on Bush's side, but in fact, there's no real reason to go all the way up to the Supreme Court, is there not? I mean, in other words, the House can bring impeachment articles, period, as is. They can bring them tomorrow.
Absolutely.
Can they not? And avoid the courts entirely, which brings me to my next thought here. Elizabeth de la Vega yesterday had said that she felt that it was as if the Bush administration was damn near asking to be impeached at this point. Mark and I were talking about that earlier. It seems as if that may be the case. Do you see that? Is that their game here? Are they actually trying to push Democrats to impeach them for some strange reason? And if so, what's the reason?
I agree with you that impeachment is in order here, and the question is whether or not Congress is going to realize that, and specifically a majority of the House of Representatives, which is where impeachment would take place. I don't think that Bush really thinks that the House of Representatives will impeach him. I think, that so far Congress has not really stood up to the president, and there are, I believe, 14 co-sponsors of the three articles of impeachment against Dick Cheney that Dennis Kucinich introduced into the House. Conyers reportedly has said, he was talking a lot about impeachment before he became the head of the House Judiciary Committee, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, and then he said impeachment is off the table, he and Nancy Pelosi, but he reportedly said that in an interview that if three more Congress people sign on to these articles of impeachment, that he will put it on the table. So that's what we need to do. One of many things we need to do is to pressure our congressional representatives to sign on to Dennis Kucinich's three articles of impeachment against Dick Cheney. The first two have to do with misrepresentations about the war, intentionally fraudulent intelligence or lack of intelligence that says that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. Number two is the connection with al-Qaeda in Iraq, which never existed. And number three is threatening Iran. And reportedly, The Guardian last week came out with an article saying that Dick Cheney finally got his way and convinced Bush to attack Iran after the first of the year. There's the third battle carrier group is headed for the Persian Gulf, and it's a very, very small gulf, and a so-called accident could happen, and then we would have to respond in so-called self-defense, and it could be a total disaster.
Heaven help us, and hopefully there won't be some manufactured Gulf of Tonkin type incident.
Right.
You just never know. We've got about 30 seconds left, Marjorie, and I wanted to get one more definition out of the way. We've talked about impeachment quite a bit. Russ Feingold is suggesting censure. What is the difference between them?
censure is a symbolic vote to basically slap the president's wrist and say, shame on you. Impeachment is a legally binding concept that the Constitution laid out to curtail executive overreaching. And impeachment takes place in the House of Representatives. That just, if there's an impeachment, like there was an impeachment of Bill Clinton, that means that it's like a complaint, like an indictment, and then it goes to the Senate for a full trial, and the conviction in the Senate takes a two-thirds majority.
All right. Well, that's about all the time we have. Marjorie, thanks for joining us. If you want to listen to Marjorie other than here on Sundays, you should go to WBAI.org and stream their audio stream from 3:10 to 3:10. There I go. 3:10 to 3:30 p.m. Eastern Time on Talkback. That's WBAI-FM, another Pacifica station. Marjorie, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it. Marjorie is president of National Lawyers Guild and teaches constitutional international law and also the author of Cowboy Republic, 6 Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law. Before that, we had Stephen Heller, a whistleblower from Diebold. Many more of them we need, I suspect. That's all the time we have. Brad, thanks again for being with me today, and hopefully you'll join us next week.
Great to be here. Let's hope there's not a constitutional crisis between now and then.
Well, we never know. That's all the time we have. As I said, this is Mark Bowie, Pokey Anderson. We join us pretty soon. If you missed any of the details of our guests tonight, go to themonitor.wordpress.com. Stay tuned now for Access This, coming up next on KPFT here in Houston. Good night.
Summer's almost over. But not quite yet. For all those interested in volunteering, listen up. At KPFT, there are 2 upcoming volunteer orientations following our phone volunteer training sessions. The orientation will last about an hour and is designed to give you an overview of the station and provide you with more details about our volunteer opportunities. We offer positions in the outreach team. We also need someone to operate the control board, assist in our music library, or create a PSA like the one you're hearing now, or a variety of other opportunities. The volunteer orientations are scheduled for Thursday, July 26th at 7 p.m. and on Sunday, July 29th at 12 noon. To sign up, call 713-5...
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.